7:13, two inmates remain on the loose from the Orleans Parish Justice Center. Rosalind Cook joins us now, adjunct professor of political science at Tulane. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Thomas?
I'm okay. I wanted to talk to you about the, first of all, not only about moving forward, what this escape could do politically to the sheriff's race and so forth, but just historically, because you've been here a while, about the history of the criminal sheriff's office and going back to, I don't know if you want to go back as far as, I guess, Fody would be as far as people remember. What would be the history of this office and the prison and or if its genesis from Orleans Parish Prison to what is it now, the Orleans Justice Center?
Correct, the Orleans Justice Center.
What was the reputation of Fody and what was it like under him? Because we tend to forget, right? And we just look at where we are without as a snapshot without realizing it's a motion picture. I guess what I'm trying to say, Professor.
Right, and if any of us as young students visited the OPP under Fody, we of course. Very, very early in our visit, realized it was a horrible facility. It's almost the idea of scared straight. Students were oftentimes brought there to show what could happen to you. And it was a facility that no one would want to be in. Now, of course, no one wants to be in a prison. But, of course, the new facility that was built 10 years ago has no comparison to what the old jail was like.
So, politically, Charles Fody was a very powerful man, correct?
Very powerful. Now, when he got to on the state level, he lost much of that power. And then, of course, after Hurricane Katrina, when he insisted on prosecuting individuals that had been involved with Katrina, and this would be like some of the medical staff, the doctors and the nurses at certain hospitals, and he was trying to prosecute them and did for the problems with Katrina and evacuating patients. I think he lost, of course, lots of support because many people that had lived through Katrina realized that this was not a textbook strategy on what you had to do. And he sort of faded away from the political scene.
So then politically, Marlon Gusman runs for sheriff, right? What happened in that race? Tell me, refresh
your memory. Well, of course, as we know, Marlon Gusman had been politically connected with Mark Morial. And Marlon Gusman, of course, did not have experience as a sheriff. But some would suggest, even though there were quite a bit of criticism about him, that he certainly had somewhat a hold on the facility, and that the criticisms were there, but nothing to the extent of what's happening right now.
So tell me what led to Marlon Gusman losing to Susan Hudson. What was the political or the political underpinnings there? What was the atmosphere like? What happened?
Well, the climate at that point was, of course, individual voters wanted change. And I think that in that sweep of wanting changes to the structure, of course, previously to that, there was a criminal sheriff and a civil sheriff, but the changes in the structure that people desired after Katrina and just wanting change, I believe, probably had a lot to do with Marlon Gusman's loss to Susan Hudson.
Tell me about the consolidation for people that don't remember of the criminal and civil sheriff's office. Did that add more responsibility to the sheriff, and did that happen while Marlon Gussman was sheriff? And was it the election an offshoot of him because of increased, I guess, responsibilities with the civil sheriff as well? Take me through all of that, if you would, please, Professor.
Yes, there was a change to making the criminal sheriff and the civil sheriff under one. You know, we previously, of course, had a civil sheriff, Paul Balto, mm-hmm. who was quite popular. And then when the election came, of course, combining those positions, which, of course, we can't look at that in a bubble either. For example, we used to have numerous assessors, and the change was to bring that under one assessor. So there were quite a bit of structural changes to the government of Orleans Parish. And this, of course, brought about the change. And again, as I said, although Marlon had quite a bit of criticism, we saw problems, certainly, in the Justice Center, but we did not have this in-your-face breakout or whatever at the time. Now, of course, we had pictures of some of the so-called residents leaving the facility and then coming back after maybe a night of partying.
Guns in the prison, right?
Guns in the prison, mm-hmm. correct. So there certainly was lots of incidents that were happening that made people apprehensive. So again, the idea of changing, I think most individuals wanted change. And Susan Hudson, of course, was the personification of that change.
Real quick before we go to the break, Professor, what led to the consent decree being imposed?
The consent decree, as you know, with the federal government, when they come in to investigate or to try to make changes in the structural institutions, can be, of course, with the police force that we certainly know quite a bit about the consent decree concerning the police force. And also the consent decree extended to other, such as the civil and the criminal sheriffs.
So what that was under Marlon Gussman's leadership that the consent decree came in, or was it Fody?
It was, it would have been under Marlon Gussman because it happened after Hurricane Katrina.
Okay, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We'll look ahead because, you know, you're saying that the people were looking for change. And I would have to believe, looking ahead to the next election after Mayor Cantrell, after the jailbreak, that you would think people in New Orleans would be looking for change. But is that necessarily going to play out or not? Rosalind Cook, our guest, adjunct professor of political science at Tulane, 722 Traffic Now, WWL. 7:26 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Rosalind Cook, adjunct professor of political science at Tulane. We always like to look back to know where we got to where we are today. And Professor, when it comes to the elections that are coming up, you know, Susan Hudson suspended her campaign. I don't know, depending on when or if somebody's recaptured, how that affects things. How do you see that playing out? And when it comes to the voters of Orleans Parish, you would think after Mayor Cantrell and a dysfunction there that they would be in the mood for a change. But what I don't know, how would that manifest itself? You got some thoughts for me?
Well, typically, the incumbent has the advantage, the individual that's holding the office, unless there's some sort of scandal or real, real situation that people decide to vote for the incumbent. Now, of course, qualifying isn't until July 9th through the 11th, which gives us still a little bit of time for interested individuals to jump into the race. Right now, of course, we have a few. Michelle Woodbrook, which was the former interim superintendent of NOPD. She, of course, had announced prior to this incident, and then she came out almost immediately with a statement after the incident. And then, of course, Susan Hudson struck back at her, suggesting that this was all political. In addition, there had been interest shown by Edwin Shorty, who's a constable, and he was a former sheriff deputy, and also Julian Parker, who was a former criminal district judge. So we have time for others to decide to qualify before that period is over. I would think that certainly there's going to be some individuals that this will play a major factor in how they decide to vote. Others, because it's still a little while, if there's individuals that really don't pay too much attention, although this story has been throughout the conventional media and also quite a bit on social media. And looking at social media, it's interesting to see what some of the comments are concerning this whole situation. So we'll have to still wait and see if there are other candidates. We'll also have to wait and see if Susan Hudson when and if she decides right now, as you said, her campaign has been suspended. So we'll have to wait and see what her decision will be. So it's going to be an interesting race no matter what. And as you said, people oftentimes do want change, and that, of course, would work in this case against Susan Hudson. Of course, it worked in her favor when she was running against Marlon Guzman. You know, she was a relatively new name in many individuals' minds, though, of course, she had been involved in other things as Inspector General. But this time, her name is out there, but it's no longer a name that will bring positive reaction to many individuals.
Thank you, Professor.
Her name is now associated with this.
I appreciate your time. Thank you, Rosalind Cook, Professor of Political Science at Tulane, 7:30, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Summertime's here, and we thought we'd take a look at what's going on with gas prices, energy demand, oil and gas, and so forth. Eric Smith joins us now, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy. How you doing, professor?
I'm doing fine. How are you this morning, Tom?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about gas prices. Where are they as it stands, I guess, historically, last year, 2 years, 3 years, et cetera?
Well, I think we're in pretty good shape. The good news is they're lower than they were this time last year, and that, you know, it depends on what you buy, but on a Louisiana average basis, the regular gasoline's about $2.70, and the premium's about $3.50. So we're in pretty good shape. Longer term, as in months, not years, we probably got most of 25 and 26 with stable prices, even going possibly going down a little bit. Of course, all bets are off if the tariffs kick in and if we have problems with the Middle East. They're the people that really set the price, and the price of gasoline, easily half of that price is the cost of the crude. So
why is the price of gas down?
It's down because the Saudis decided they would start producing more, and I can't blame it all on the Saudis. The U.S. is attempting to produce more itself. With varying levels of success, I have to say, but we are producing more crude in the Permian, and we're trying to produce more in the Gulf of Mexico.
So this is what I try to always understand when I talk to you. It seems as though the Saudis have they're holding the strings. They're the puppet masters, because we can try to drill, baby, drill, or we can try to produce as much as we want, but all the Saudis have to do is open the spigot, and then there it goes, or not really?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. They are, as you know, an autocratic regime, so they don't have a lot of discussion when they decide to change the price. Mm-hmm. But even the Saudis have to debate with everybody else in OPEC. And, of course, right now their big bugaboo is the Kazakhs in Kazakhstan, who want to produce as much as they can, and that tends to be one of the reasons the Saudis are raising their production volume, is to try and teach everybody else a lesson. They did this once before, as you well know. So
yeah,
it's when they get ready to do it, it's like everything else, is a little bit of a lag factor. But for them, it's a relatively straightforward matter of issuing orders and orders being obeyed, and the additional spare capacity that they keep on hand all the time is allowed to come online. It's never more than a million or so barrels a day, but still in a 100 million barrel a day market, that's measurable. So it has its effects.
So if I'm going to draw three circles, one with the Saudis, one with OPEC, and one with the Kazakhs, who is driving what? Who's leading what?
Well, the Saudis are the biggest producer, but the Kazakhs have some of the least expensive oil. They're also closer to China, so they have another land outlet, if you will, without having to go to sea. All the Saudi oil has to go by boat. So, you know, they have pros and cons. I would suggest, though, that OPEC and OPEC Plus, which even includes Russia, is overwhelmingly driven by Saudi intentions.
So it all comes back to the Saudis, accurate?
Yes, I think that's right.
So they can either, they pretty much control. When it comes to, here's, I guess, what I'm trying to get to, Professor, and I know this is very complicated stuff, but when it comes to how much we pay for gasoline, we want to thank this one, blame that one, but ultimately it always goes back to the Saudis, or not really Saudis?
Well, it goes back to the Saudis when you're talking about global supplies. But don't forget, every country on Earth wants to be sovereign of its own, control of its own destiny, and wants to be able to have some degree of control over the price of products that go to their publics. In the case of the U.S., we have a range of prices even today for gasoline, the same standardized gasoline. Our premium gasoline, as I was saying, is, you know, selling somewhere in the $3.50 range. You could add a couple of bucks if you were in California. And it's not that they don't have oil, it's that they have a bunch of other costs and taxes that they've imposed on the oil they do produce. And they actively discourage producing oil, so they're actually importing both crude and gasoline into California today. They've got two more refineries representing about 20% of their capacity that's threatening to close down, one of them Valero. So, you know, they just don't put gasoline very high on their priority list.
With an eye toward the environment, Professor, that's why they're doing it?
Yeah, I think that's what the primary argument would be, is they want to control the environment, and they don't want to stop driving.
So they're going to make people pay more for gas is going to be the end result of this, if you live in California?
Yes, and they want to mandate things like the use of internal combustion engines in cars. The rest of the country is up in arms over that, and although the prior administration, the Democrats, did give them permission to pass those kinds of rules, the current administration's actively rescinding them. So,
all right, let me take a break. We're going to pick it up. We come back. We're talking to Professor Eric Smith, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy. If you have any questions, somebody texted in, the U.S. produces more oil than Saudi Arabia. Do they, Professor?
They do. But the fact of the matter is, it's not just Saudi that the Saudis control. They control through these organizations like OPEC about a third of the world's production.
So if Saudi Arabia wanted to produce more,
as a single country, we produce as much, sometimes more, than the Saudis or the Russians do.
But if Saudi Arabia wanted to produce more, they could?
They can.
Yeah, they can.
And if we're talking a million, 2 million barrels a day, that's maximum. They can ramp it up.
All right, let's talk about EVs when we come back. Somebody texted about they see a lot of EVs on the road. Does that have any effect on gasoline prices and demand? And does that, as a result, mean lower prices? We'll find out. We come back talking to Eric Smith, our friend, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy. No questions too dumb. I prove that every time I ask one. Traffic now, WWL. Hi, 7:56 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Eric Smith, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy, talking about gas prices being down from where they were last year and looking pretty good into the rest of 25-26. Accurate, professor?
Yes, pretty accurate.
All right, let's talk about somebody texting about they see a lot of Teslas on the road, a lot of EVs, and they're wondering if that in any way is causing for a diminished demand for gasoline, which means increased supply and therefore lower prices.
Well, actually, we all are seeing more of the EVs on the road, but they're very noticeable. I mean, a Tesla, you see from its profile or from the noise level or whatever you want to use as your indicator, we're overestimating how many of them are on the road.
Kind of like when you get a red car, all of a sudden everybody has a red car?
That's right. That's exactly the same thing. There's not a whole lot not to like about the electric cars, whether it's a Tesla or a Rivian or something else. It's a wonderful high-end automobile. It's an expensive automobile.
Well, I'll tell you what, I rode in one of these Lumieres in Washington, a hotel car, I guess it is. Have you ever been in one of those, Professor?
I have not. You're in a different tax bracket than I am.
No, not really. It was a comp trip, believe me. But it was it's like a very heavy ride, because I guess the vehicles are so heavy, very stable, very smooth ride, and it surprised me. It really did. Of course, there's still
very good handling too, because it's all of that weight slow in the car. So,
and you got to make sure you can, you know, power it. That's the problem. So let's talk about.
Well, that's right.
Let's talk about. Somebody texted in and wants to know about refining capacity and how does that affect our oil prices? Because you talked about California shutting down two refineries. We've not built a refinery in this country in a long time, right?
Well, that's right. We keep enhancing the ones we've got. As you know, PBF here in New Orleans just spent $500 million on a rebuild of its facilities, and the other refineries are doing the same sorts of things. In the case of PBF, of course, they were trying to make renewable diesel to ship out to California. Valero's doing the same thing locally. You can say that's an expansion of capacity, of course. It's good for the refiners, but it doesn't really increase the amount of crude oil that gets processed, because you're processing vegetable and animal oils.
Somebody wants to know if we'll ever see dollar and a quarter gasoline again, dollar quarter a gallon.
Not in my lifetime, I don't think.
Okay.
I think one of the things people underestimate, though, and it does impact Louisiana quite a bit, is that the predominant source of dispatchable power still in the United States, close to 80% of the power, is coming from things like nuclear and natural gas. And when you stop drilling for oil, you stop drilling for the associated gas that comes up with it. That reduces the supply of gas, which means the gas going into those gas generators, combined cycle plants, et cetera, is more expensive. So your cost of the basic electrons goes up. Of course, you got to deliver them. So we don't have the infrastructure, really, to suddenly switch over to 50%.
Thank you, Professor.